I had a real experience, which some of you may be familiar with this week. Two experiences, actually. I was going to go to the Siyum HaShas. Did you hear about the completion of the 7.5-year cycle of the daily folio of 2,211 pages or something? 7.5-year cycle. Anyway, so I was at Continental Arena, which is one of two venues that were, you know, filled up. The other one was Madison Square Garden and some other smaller places. And it was just a sight to see and an experience to have, just an unbelievable experience, particularly when an 80-something-year-old man actually made the completion, actually finished the last few lines of the last tractate of the last order of the Talmud, and in so doing he shared what he'd seen, because he started this cycle of studying a page a day in 1938.
Wow.
In Europe, before the Holocaust, obviously, and he described a certain luminary rabbi. As a matter of fact, the rabbi after whom Yeshiva University is named, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, he described him when he started studying as a young child, as a teenager, and so he cried his way through it. Just and then the whole thing was dedicated to the memory of the 6 million. And to look around and see 20-something thousand people all united about celebrating the study of Talmud, and to know that the same exact thing was going on. We were hooked up by by video to Madison Square Garden, so the speeches alternated, and you had the big fanograms in the middle of the arena with these, you know, right next to the New York Mets pennants that celebrated various victories. You had these passages, Torah Hashem Tamimah Meshivat Nefesh, the Torah of God is perfect, and assuages the soul. It was an amazing experience, really was. And then when he finished, there was a spontaneous outbreak of Siman Tamu Mazel Tov, and he had 20-something thousand people just dancing in the aisles. And I was sitting next to total strangers, and there was no way we were not going to embrace and hold hands and dance. It was just an amazing thing. It just went on and on and on. I don't know if you saw it by the satellite hookup, but it was, I understand that there were like 100,000 people connected by satellite hookups to different things. And Chicago had a full smaller auditorium in Los Angeles. Amazing thing. Anyway, it was very uplifting. The second experience was that I was afraid I was going to miss it because of the snowstorm that hit the Northeast. And so rather than take a chance, because 7.5 years ago I did not go, and I promised myself that I would go no matter what. So comes the snowstorm, and they're saying it's going to snow all night. And Monday afternoon I'm looking at the plane schedules, and they're canceling flights into Newark. And I'm supposed to fly Tuesday morning, and I don't want to miss it. I said, that's it. I called Amtrak, and they're leaving at 8:06 on Monday night, and I got on a train, and then upgraded to a sleeper by the time I got to Sokoa, and I had a great time on the train. It was just amazing. Great time. Anyway, and as the conductor is preparing my bed at 11 o'clock at night, he says, we have a kosher breakfast for you. And I don't know, I had no reservation. I don't know how they had it. And then, as I'm walking down the thing, some Russian Jew sticks his head out of one of the little sleepers and says, I've got some kosher food for you. Got some kosher potatoes. He says, I don't keep kosher, but I know it's kosher. Anyway. All right, so while we're waiting for the outlines, let's go through a summary, just to get you back into it mentally, of what we did last week, okay? So we saw, first of all, we established or tried to demonstrate that history is nothing other than the unfolding of forces that are installed into the universe at the time of creation. That the world itself is created to reflect certain forces. And so in the world itself, we're going to have certain currents, certain ideologies, certain oppositional forces that are there waiting to be played out. And so it's just a question of time and circumstance where these realities will be played out. And they have to be played out. The world is there specifically for that to happen. So I want to just amplify on that a little bit, because it's going to be very important to appreciate what we're going to do tonight. When we talk about this idea of the world is there for these things to happen, we're turning the whole picture of reality on its head. What we're saying is that we have reality wrong. We think reality is that things happen, and whatever happens, that's reality. No, We don't understand. Reality exists before things happen. Things happen in order for us to learn about reality through the events. The events are not reality. They are a reflection of reality, which means, and we talked about it last year with the playwright, right? So the idea is there. The concept is there. The truth is there. For the truth to be played out, God creates a physical universe in which these things can be brought into the world. So very often what God is going to do is he's going to actually create something that's contrary to the truth, which is also part of it, because through the challenge and through the transcendence over the challenge, the truth is going to be brought out. It's going to be manifest. So therefore, there's always going to be struggle. Until the conclusion of human history, there is always going to be struggle. The room is not balanced. There's more people on the left. What happened to the guys on the right? The guys on the right didn't want to come back this week. Yes, I feel like I have to stand more over here. So, yeah. Anyway, so there's always going to be a struggle. It's always going to, because the struggle is the fleshing out of certain ideas and the alternative possibilities to those ideas. The world itself is where that's played out. And so history is not what we think it is. We think of history as unfolding, and because of circumstances, the classic historian, when he looks at an event like the French Revolution, he doesn't say the French Revolution was an idea waiting to happen. He doesn't say that at all. What a classic historian says, the French Revolution was a result of socioeconomic and political forces that all converged at the same time, that out of a combination of convenience and ideology and circumstance and timing, all happened to result in what we call the French Revolution, which is the beginning of the Republic, which is the beginning of a form of, you know, a form of government, and so on and so forth. Judaism would look at that kind of a thing and say, where is the idea of the French Republic, the Third Republic? Where does that exist before the Republic exists? And then the Judaism would say that it's just a question of where it's going to unfold in the world. It's something that had to happen. Now, I'm using the Third Republic as an example. I don't believe that that's really true. I don't believe that the Third Republic is a basic theme of humanity. It is, by the way, an expression of, or a tangential expression of something that was going to happen, and maybe we'll even refer indirectly to it today. It's really an expression of what happens, I'll say this now and then you'll understand a little later. It is an expression of man's attempt to create order. Esau, particularly, the arch enemy of the Jewish people and a descendant of Isaac, who believes very much in action and initiative and accomplishments, you're gonna find the seeds of democracy in Esau, believe it or not. Democracy is not entirely a bad thing and not entirely a good thing. It's what it is. But so I'm just saying that we see history as the playing out of certain forces. Let me say one more thing about this before we go on to finish the summary of last week. The classic example is something that happens in the book of Exodus, which eludes our attention because it's like it just sneaks by. But if you pay attention to it, it's almost laughable. God is telling Moses to convey certain commandments to the children of Israel in Egypt. This is right before they're going to be freed. Here it is. Yeah. So, God says that, tells Moshe, speak to the children of Israel and tell them that certain commandments. And he says, you should observe 7 days of the Matzah festival. On the seventh day is a festival for God. Matzah shall be eaten 7 full days. You shall not see any leaven or sourdough in all of your boundaries on Pesach. And then he says, this is chapter 13, verse 8. And you shall tell your children on that day, saying, because of this did God do for me when I came out of Egypt. Because of this did God do for me when I came out of Egypt. So what is this? What is this? This is quoted in the Haggadah. This is one of the four statements that is used to assign to one of the four sons. So because of this did God do, what is this? Because of what? I mean, I just read you what it said. Because of what? So Rashi, the classic commentator, says, on the word because of this, Rashi says, Ba'avur she'akayem mitzvasav, in order that I shall fulfill his commandments, kagon, for example, Pesach, Matzah, Umaror, Halalu, the Passover sacrifice, the eating of the Matzah, the consumption of the bitter herbs that are here on the table, that's why God did this to take me out of Egypt. So, you're supposed to say to your son, do you know why God took me out of Egypt? So I can eat Matzah. So that's the exact opposite. Anybody knows that the reason we eat matzah is because God took us out of Egypt. And it was too, we didn't have enough time for the bread to rise and melos, so we eat the bread. It's symbolic. It reminds us of the exodus of Egypt. So it should be that God took me out of Egypt, I eat matzah because God took me out of Egypt. But the passage says the exact opposite. Because of this, so that I should be able to do this, eat this matzah and eat this bitter herb, did God take me out of Egypt. What does that mean? What that means is that there is no such thing. There is no such thing as a commemoration of an event. The event is nothing other than a revelatory incident that teaches me a truth. Matzah is true before this Passover. The knowledge, the awareness of God through matzah, whatever that would be, let's call it the freedom connection to God. The empowerment of freedom that God gives us in a relationship with God, we're free and unlimited in terms of maximizing who we are as human beings when we're connected to God. That's called freedom. So that freedom is there before there's an exodus. That concept of freedom exists before there's an exodus from Egypt, before there's a bondage, before there's a problem that, for which we need a solution. God then brings us into Egypt in order for us to experience slavery, in order for us to experience his redemption, so that we can experience the truth of the matzah through the perspective of the event of the freedom from Egypt. So therefore, the matzah is the main point. The story is the excuse to appreciate and have insight into the connection to God through the matzah. And therefore, God took me out of Egypt so that I could eat the matzah. I don't eat the matzah because he took me out of Egypt. So therefore, the truth is, and that's why you have these midrashim that sound ridiculous. I'll get to you in a second, Terry. We have these crazy midrashim that say, for example, that when, oh, they're here. Thank you. So these midrashim that say that when Abraham was sitting at the entrance of his tent and he is greeting the angels and he feeds them, it says there that he gave them matzah. Right? Because it was Passover. Well, what's going on? How could it be Passover before there was Egypt? The answer is because Passover is true without the event. The event only teaches you how to appreciate freedom. But the freedom relationship with God is there beforehand. So Abraham didn't need Egypt and freedom from Egypt in order to celebrate Passover because he was in touch with the truth of that connection to God through matzah without the event. So therefore, it turns the whole concept of what history is on its head, and the whole idea of what's going on in the story of humanity on its head. We're here in order to bring down certain truths into the world. You're going to hear something interesting in a minute. Yes? Right. So what you're referring to is the famous Zohar, actually it's a Zohar, Istakil Be'oraisa Ubara Alma, which is Aramaic for he looked, he gazed at the Torah and created the world. The idea is that the Torah pre-exists the world. It's not a way of living in the world. The Torah is not a manual, a set of instructions about how to go through life. The Torah comes before life. Life is a setting in which the Torah can be lived out, so that we go through life in order to realize the truth of the Torah. It's not that we have life first, and then God says, hey, you're here, okay, I'll tell you how to live. No, we got the Torah first, and God says, oh, we got a Torah, I'll give you a life so you can live out the Torah. Right? So the reality is not here. This is a reflection of reality. The reality is up there, so to speak, and we are trying to get into that reality by seeing through life that which existed and caused life. Life is that which comes after the truth. The truth causes the world to be, and in the world we come and discover that which caused the, everything in the world to be. The world is a stage, and the world is nothing but a stage to play the game. Okay.
So before.
What's that? They had, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the reason for it before?
The, I don't know.
Coming out.
I don't know.
And he came to visit, and Sarah didn't have time for the witch to
arrive. That's, I don't know, that sounds like a, literally a housewife's tale, right?
Wow.
But,
are you saying that all of history is predetermined?
No, no. I can't believe it. I missed George coming in. Oh, perfect. Okay. Okay. Oh, there is one. Thank you. Oh, okay, good. You got it anyway. You got enough there? Does everybody have one? Great question. Are we saying that history is predetermined? Yes and no, which means the following. There's going to be darkness on the face of the deep. That's built into the world. Darkness, we said last time, was this veil over the wisdom of the Torah. There's going to be another force that's going to make it difficult for us to see the wisdom of the Torah, which is God's wisdom. That's darkness. That's going to be Greek philosophy, which is powerful, which is beautiful, and which adds a lot, but it clouds our vision of the Torah, and so on and so forth. And it's going to be on the face of the deep. It's going to come in the context of an endless exile, the deep and endless bottomless exile known as a Roman exile. So that's going to be. How that happens and how we deal with it and exactly the timing and so on and so forth, that's up to human response. But we're going to have to deal with it. We're going to have to deal with those forces. So it's like gravity is there. There's nothing we can do about it. When we're born, gravity is there. But how we deal with gravity, you know, do we drive off a cliff or not, that's our decision. So the way human history unfolds is not preordained, but that there's going to be a force called an Ishmael that we're going to talk about tonight, that there's going to be a force called an Israel, a Yitzchak, who's going to be in a combative relationship with Ishmael, that there's going to be an Esav, that there's going to be the breakdown of society that I'm going to maintain is still not fully unraveled. That's going to happen. It's got to happen because the proper order has got to be restored. The only way you can restore order is to break down the imposed order. And we're now living an artificial non-reflection of the original thing. That's what I'm going to try to get to today. I'm going to try to sound as rational as I can. I realize that if you walk in here without any of the introductions, I sound like a raving lunatic. Even with the introduction, I don't sound exactly sane. But we'll see. So just to remind you again, very quickly, I don't want to take too much more time. So we saw about those forces in history. We saw that the distinctive characteristic of man is choice, that man has initiative, creativity, man is a decisor, like God. We saw that man relates to God because man is the only creature that is created with the capacity to imitate and look like God, and that's for the potential of relationship, because we saw that relationship can only happen between beings that have like characteristics. We saw that man is only potential because man is, I'm pointing to the board, it's not there anymore, that man is from the earth. Earth is all about potential. So therefore man is born, unlike all the other animals and the creatures in the world, man is actually born unable to survive himself. Man is the only creature that enters the world with nothing but potential, because he can't even walk, can't even get his own food, can't do whatever, and he has to grow. Man is so totally about growing into something and becoming, whereas everybody else, all other creatures, are born with the basic equipment. It takes a couple hours and they're up on their own. And they're just a little smaller and weaker, but whatever they're going to be, they are already. We saw that man is representative and of the whole creation. That's why God says, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man, meaning man is going to be in a sum total of everything else that came before him, and that's going to be, by the way, the Jewish play on evolution, is that man, in a certain sense, does evolve purposefully as a creation of God, but it's supposed to come from and of the rest of the world, because man is really the concert master. He's really the conductor of all of creation, and therefore has to have a bit of all of that in there, and therefore Na'aseh Adam. And finally, we saw that man rises by imitating God. We saw the word Adama, which is earth, and we saw Adama also as Adameh, which means I will imitate, I will be similar to God. So that's the nature of man. Now, let us introduce Ishmael. So this outline that you have in front of you, we're really picking up on Roman numeral 3. I kind of revised the outline from last week a little bit. So it kind of flows from last week, but I cheated a little bit and changed number 3. If you have last week, it won't hurt you. So let's get into the emergence of Ishmael, because we are now today dealing very, very much with Ishmael. First, let's go to the very to today. Let's go to today. When Ishmael is born, he grows up, and for some reason, which we can't get into, it's a fascinating discussion, and it's a lot there, but Sarah says, get him out of the house. So after Abraham doesn't, God says, listen to Sarah, she's right. This guy cannot grow up with Yitzchak, and he's kicked out. So during the time that he almost dies in the desert of thirst, she gets a prophecy, and she's told that that Ishmael is going to be para adam, like a wild ass of a man, is I think the way they translate it. Yeah. I may have just mixed up two biblical narratives. Excuse me for 1 second. I did. No, it's about Ishmael, but I said it the wrong place. This is when he's born. 1 second. Give me 1 second here. Oh, here it is, yeah. Well, I don't want to waste the time to get the exact passage, but he is called Tera Adam, which means that, and the passage goes on and says, Yadoba Kovi Yad Kovo, his hand will be in all, and all will be dependent on him. And the Aramaic translation and other commentators as well say that this is biblical prophecy, saying that there'll come a time when Ishmael will have a major effect and will be able to hold, so to speak, the world hostage. I'm almost translating literally. And everybody will be dependent on him. That's Yadoba Kol V'Yad Kol Bo. As well, he will be Pera Adam, which means that he will be a wild ass of a man, which means he will be Adam. He will be an Adam, but the Adam is the modifier of the Pera, which means there's, in Hebrew, you have, let's say you want to say a large man. So you write, the word for man in Hebrew is Adam. Right? Adam. Okay, and there I go again with my, okay, whatever, okay, you got it, okay, Adam. So, that's man. Suppose you want to say a large man, so you write Adam Gadol. So, where is the adjective? After the noun. Noun, adjective. Man, large, that means large man. In English we say the adjective first. Yellow man, large man, stupid man, the adjective goes first. In Hebrew, the adjective almost always goes afterwards. So, when you have the word Tera Adam, okay, which means, well, this is wild, and this means man, so what is the modifier here? Gadol, large, this would be the modifier. So the modifier, the adjective, is Adam, and he's like man-like. But Tera is the noun. Tera Adam, which means he's going to be this wild creature who's modified by man-like characteristics. I realize that's not politically correct, because we're saying that this Ishmael over here is the Ishmael that we're dealing with nowadays. And it's not politically correct, because political correctness didn't come from the Torah. If it had come from the Torah, then it would be politically incorrect, because people don't say what the Torah says, they say what they say. People made up political correctness, therefore it's wrong. Okay, so the Torah does believe that different nations have different characteristics. We absolutely do it. In that sense, we are literally, in the literal sense of the word, racist. We do not necessarily use those differences to put down other races, but we absolutely do believe that races have different characteristics and that all men are created with equal connection to God, but they are not created the same. They are created very different. And they each have come to contribute something different to God's creation and not the same thing, and not whatever they want to contribute, but whatever they're made to contribute, which is a totally different thing. So here, God is describing the role that Ishmael is going to play in the world, Per Adam. So I'm just fast forwarding to the end of the picture now, just to say that there's, without getting into any interpretation, so we have the world obsessed with and focused on the Middle East, where there is a huge movement of hundreds of millions of Muslims who profess to be at least the spiritual descendants of Ishmael, who say that they are the primary son of Abraham, who say that Isaac is the rejected son of Abraham, who say that they are the ones who really need to have Mount Moriah. This is my battery dying. I'm meant to be recharging it. I'm sorry about that. Let me just repass it. All right. Who say that they're the ones who need to be at Mount Moriah, not Isaac, that Ishmael was the one who sacrificed there, and so on and so forth. And they claim that they're the heirs to the line of Abraham. And, say they, and the whole world is obsessed with their power in the sense, forget about the terrorism for a minute, the whole world long ago, starting with somewhere in the 60s and 70s, as we developed, as Esau, as the Western world developed technology, which is dependent on oil, all of a sudden, our advances in technology create a dependence on the product of Ishmael, which is oil. So that as Esau supposedly becomes independent, this is fascinating, Esau supposedly becomes independent by developing technology and therefore having machines that does his work, the problem is those machines are hungry and the people who have the food for the machines happen to be the people who are the descendants of Ishmael, at least spiritually, if not genetically. And so therefore, that's already the fulfillment of Yadov HaKol V'Yatovov. His hand is in everyone, and everyone needs him. Then we have this major challenge to civilization that occurs right now. Major challenge. The entire world. You can't go anywhere in the world without being affected by the fear that what you're doing right now could be disrupted by terrorism. You can't go into a business, into an office. You can't go into a plane. You can't travel anywhere. You realize that do you realize that Ishmael, in the name of Allah, literally closed down the entire world in 9/11? They didn't just destroy two towers and part of the Pentagon and crash a plane in Pennsylvania. The world shut down. What is the gate of a city in modern times?
Airport.
I mean, okay, so there was not a single plane from San Francisco to Maine was allowed to be in the air for 2 or 3 days until we figured out when the world was going on. And the United States is the leading exporter of travel, of passengers, of tourism, industry, and so on and so forth. I mean, so when the United States shuts down, Paris shuts down, Iceland shuts down, Canada shuts down, Mexico shuts down, South America shuts down, I mean, the world shuts down. So we're talking about an extremely powerful, powerful enemy here, which, because of our own arrogance, we don't like to admit, has really got us by the throat. And the fact is that every single individual on the planet has a lifestyle change because of what's gone on with Ishmael. Because we now expect to spend an extra hour or two getting anywhere we're going because we have to succumb to the security thing because we are truly not secure. We don't know how to manipulate the world anymore without being the threat of having our own planes turn into bombs that can destroy pieces of cities. It's just crazy. So I'm not even saying it's good or bad. It's just a shocking development. And it's several years later, we're still living in a daily way in the fear of that. So we're already living the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy of Ishmael. But I want to demonstrate where this comes from, and I want to demonstrate where terrorism comes from, and how terrorism is the perfect tool and the perfect self-expression for Ishmael, and that it was almost what could have been predicted. A matter of fact, it kind of is. So first of all, who does Yishmael come from? So Yishmael comes from Abraham. But not just Abraham. He comes from somebody else too. He comes from Hagar. Hagar is his mother, Hagar. And Hagar is the daughter of Pharaoh. Hagar from the Egyptian. So Hagar is comes from Egypt. So now, just a little bit of that biblical genetics. Abraham, we have Noah, okay? Noah. Well, let's do it in English. I don't need Hebrew for this. You know what? I can do it a lot faster if I just copy from these guys. They have a nice bill here. So we have this is fascinating. We'll find out that the Jewish people are a purposeful result of inbreeding. And whenever we don't inbreed, we get in trouble. Well, at least back then, not now. Then we get in trouble. So we have, oh boy, long time. There it is. Okay. We have Noah. Right, Noah. And he has three sons. Shem. Ham. And Japheth. Okay. Now, Shem ultimately produces a guy named, let's see, what are we going to do? How far back should we go? Okay, well, let's say, if you just follow the biblical story, Shem gets to, eventually, after several generations, gets to Terah, who is the father of Abraham, and Haran and Nahar. I'm doing this without the chart. Okay. So Haran died, evidently childless. Nahar ends up giving birth to Sarah. Oh, there it goes. English. Okay. Sarah, so and so forth. Abraham marries her. He produces, among other things, an Isaac. And Isaac is going to marry Rebecca. She also comes. She's a cousin. Isaac with Rebecca produces a Jacob and an Esau. Jacob marries also a cousin from Aram the Haran, which is all descendants of Shem. Now, Ham and Japheth get together and pull a real dinger on Noah, and Noah basically curses Ham, and Japheth, which is going to produce grief, by the way. Japheth is all about beauty. Yofi, beauty. Japheth ends up producing Yavan. That's Hebrew for Yavan, and the reason I do that is so you see something very interesting. You see these lines getting bigger and bigger? Wait till Hanukkah and I'll explain it to you. But anyway, so that's Greek. Okay? Alright, so Ham has one of his children is Mitzrayim. One of his offspring is Mitzrayim, Egypt. Hagar comes from the king of Egypt and she marries Abraham. And they have a child and he is Ishmael. Okay. So now what you have is this. Ham is cursed, which means, what does a curse mean? A curse doesn't mean bad things that happen to you. Johnny Carson said, you should say, may a caravan of camels relieve itself on your front lawn. That's not a curse. A curse is when you're distant from God. A curse is that you don't have a connection to God. That's a curse. Because God's the source. If you're disconnected from the source, you dry up, you shrivel up, and so on and so forth. Blessing is that you're actually connected to the source. That's what bracha is. Bracha is that you're connected to the source. Egypt, coming from Ham, who is cursed, meaning that Ham, the only way that Ham has a relationship to God, according to Noah's curse, is the Tanan Eva Memo. His offspring have to be a servant to Shem by attaching themselves and totally subjugating themselves to the descendants of Shem, who is the Blessed One. He is going to have some connection to God, but alone he ain't going to have it. She comes along, the daughter of Pharaoh, and she wants a connection. Abraham is a worldwide movement. It's clear from the biblical account that Abraham is a source of a world war. There's the war of the kings. Everybody's worked up because Abraham has taken on Nimrod. Nimrod is the major power after the Tower of Babel. Nimrod has set himself up as a god. Abraham says, no, there is nobody in the world who is God other than God himself, who controls the whole world. There's no god of this and god of that. And Abraham is basically a major challenge to the world order. Parenthetically, Abraham is a restoration of man, the beginning of man restoring himself to the shape of Adam, way up there. Before the sin, Adam, who we discussed last week, and what his potential is and what he stands for. So things got out of hand, and Abraham begins a movement called the Jewish people. God says, you're going to be a people through which all the nations of the world will be blessed. What does that mean? All the nations of the world will be connected to God through what you're going to do. So Abraham is the beginning of this revolutionary thing, gets Hagar's attention. She, according to the Midrash, has a great thirst for matters spiritual. And so she leaves and tries to unite with Abraham. She wants to connect to Abraham. By the way, the reason that when God sends her back after she's cast out, that she has to be submissive and be afflicted is because the only way she cannot connect to Abraham as an equal. She comes from Ham. She can only connect to Abraham as a servant. That's a whole predictable chain of events. It's not a personal thing about Abraham and Hagar and so on and so forth. This is a whole thing playing out here. So, from Abraham, the source of faith, from Abraham, the one who understands that there is one God who runs the whole world, and Hagar, who is a product of Egypt, we'll discuss what that is in a minute, comes Ishmael. So Ishmael is going to be an interesting graph. The spiritual Ishmael, I'm talking about the spiritual child, forget about his genes. So much the spiritual product of Ishmael, and I don't mean the product of the environment. I'm talking about his neshama, his soul, the force that's inserted into the world, is going to be a grafting of what Abraham stands for and what Egypt stands for. What does Egypt stand for? So very quickly, because this is not essential other than to get the mood. First of all, who does Egypt worship? What's the god of Egypt? Ra, that's true. What else? Was that?
A lot of gods.
Yeah, a lot of gods, but particularly the Nile. Egypt's god is the Nile. Why? Because the Nile is the source of all of their sustenance, right? And so they see the Nile as the source of all blessing, and they worship the Nile. Interesting thing, among other things about the Nile, is that it's down here, not up there. Egypt is sitting there looking at the ground. I'm serious. And they're worshiping a river that flows through the earth. And it's a very physical thing. The name for Egypt, Mitzrayim, means a lot of things, but among other things, it means Mitzar, which is narrow. It's spiritually asphyxiating. They're very focused on the physical, very focused on the physical universe. And that's why their god, Ra is also part of this, by the way, but we won't get into that now, how that works out. But that's why their god is the Nilus, the Nile River, because the Nile River is this physical source of blessing. So you get this weird creature called Ishmael. Ishmael has two things in his name. Ishmael, let's do it in Hebrew for a minute. I'm putting a dash in here so I won't be writing God's name. Ishmael. Ishmael. God will listen. Okay? So, he's got God in his name. Okay? Hagar was definitely interested in Abraham's faith. She's definitely interested in God himself. And she has Ishmael named with God in there. God will listen. What our sages tell us about Ishmael is that there's a claim or a philosophy let's go to 3B. Heaven to earth or earth to heaven. This is the philosophy we're going to talk about. What is the job of man in his encounter with God? Is it to bring earth up to heaven, or is it to bring heaven down to earth? In other words, there's got to be a unity between the physical and the spiritual. So we have God up there, removed, non-physical. We have the earth down here, physical, temporary. We have physical drives down here on earth. We have spiritual drives reflected, so to speak, in heaven. And we've got to bring those together because God is the source of everything on the earth. Do we bring the earth, the world, up to heaven, or do we bring heaven down to earth? Say the same thing another way, which is, do we make my will God's will, or do we make God's will my will? Which means, say it another way, the sages say that when the children of Israel worship idols, they never worship idols other than in an interest to have free sex. Okay, that's what the sages say. That every time the children of Israel wander after idols, all they want is a God who can't stop them from doing what they want. The source of idolatry, the passion for idolatry, is freedom from responsibility, freedom from accountability. Because if you can find a God who can't get you, then you can do what you want. So idolatry is there in order to remove morality. Morality itself is a reflection of the fact that there's an authority. And idolatry is nothing other than a fancy way of saying that I've made God's will my will. Whatever I want is what God really wants. That's Yishmael. Yishmael says, of course there's a God. And that's an improvement over what's going on in Chum and Mitzrayim and so on and so forth. Of course there's a God. But Yishmael, God hears, which means that God is, oh, whatever I say, that's what God hears. Interesting medrash now. It talks about, and this is where I have the dust of your feet. The medrash has, when Abraham is at the, right after his circumcision, and he's at the door of his tent, and God sends these angels, which are going to tell him about the birth of Isaac. So it has Abraham running out. The passage has Abraham running out and greeting the guests, and he says, come on in. Please, if I find favor in your eyes, please don't pass me. Take a little water and wash your feet and rest under the tree. What's this washing your feet business? First of all, if you're trying to show that you want guests, you want them to feel comfortable, do you tell them your feet are dirty? Don't come into my house with your dirty feet. Here's some water. Well, here's some water and take a drink, right? What does he say? Here's some water and wash your feet. It's odd for a guy who's sitting there passionately begging people to come in. Come in with your dirt. I love you so much. I don't care if you have dirt on your feet. So the Medrash says that this is Abraham. The only thing Abraham had in mind whenever he was taking in the guests was to share with them the truth of the one God above. His whole idea was, it was like a Lubavitcher. Give you a nice Shabbos lunch, and I'll teach you about God. Right? So the whole idea here is that he is saying, take the dust. There used to be a culture in which the dust of their feet was worshipped. What does that mean that they worship the dust on their feet? What kind of a philosopher would worship the dust on your feet? The idea is that the dust of your feet is the earth. If you can say that God is down here, right, then you've brought heaven down to earth. If you brought heaven down to earth, then what you say is that what I want is actually what God wants. So which gets back to the whole idea of idolatry. Idolatry ultimately is, I don't want to deal with the authority of God, but I know there is a God. So what I'll do is, I'll say that God wants whatever I want. As a matter of fact, I always want what God wants, because whatever I want is God's will. It's just the way. So that's called bringing heaven down to earth. The ultimate manifestation of that is worshiping the dust on your feet. So therefore, Abraham said, no, I'm not going to have idolatry in my house, which is his way of teaching people, his washing the dust off your feet. There's a God in the world. He's up there. We have to reach him. We're not bringing him down here. So this is the idea of Abraham. This is what Abraham stood for. Yishmael, however, stands for an entirely different concept, which is invoking the name of God to endorse whatever it is that I want. And that's the source of the concept of Terra Adam, of a man-like wild creature, which means that whatever I want is okay. So therefore, there's no question. The last words that were uttered by the terrorists before they destroyed the Twin Towers and they died themselves was Allah Akbar, that God is wonderful, God is great. right? In the name of God, they did this, which is the ultimate desecration of God's name. Why? Because if I want it, that is what God wants. And therefore, they're always dying a martyr's death. Everything they do against any enemy they have is always God's will. It's always, because the point is, what they want is what God wants. They don't want what God wants. God wants whatever it is that they want. Very interesting thing. I heard an Islamic scholar once talking, I wish I knew his name. I wish I remembered his name. But I'll never forget this, because there is no equivalent in Islam of a code of Jewish law. There is. There is a code of law in Islam. There absolutely is. But there is absolutely no authoritative interpretation of what that code is and when it applies and when it doesn't and what passage in the Quran means what, which is very consistent with the notion that the Quran is not going to be a law book which requires very specific adaptation of human behavior to fit into a higher standard. The idea is that it's going to be free enough for us to be able to talk about being spiritual and being connected to God, but not so much that I don't have room to maneuver in terms of the things that I want to get accomplished in the world. So this is the philosophy, so to speak, of Ishmael, which is, I would say that it's definitely a God-oriented philosophy. And it's very interesting that we have nowadays the power of Ishmael is always done in the name of God, and the most destructive forces, the ones that are giving us the biggest trouble, are the ones who are the most religious. Very interesting. Compare that just for contrast, not to say that we are better, because we have our own problems, and we, by the way, the Jewish people, that's part three next week, I'm going to maintain that we are much more destructive than Ishmael. So don't think that I think we're so great. I'm not sure, but compare the religious camp in the Jewish world and what it does in the name of religion historically, even up until this day when we have certain manifestations of religious extremism in Israel, with unbelievably scant evidence of any militarism or any holy war in which you go and slay the enemy in the name of God. The religious camp is overwhelmingly dominated by peacefulness, by Torah study, by surrender to halacha, by structure, by self-control, and so on and so forth, and very, very little imposition through force. Because halacha, by definition, says that my will is not the interest, is not the main point. But when you don't have a halacha, then everything becomes whatever it is that you want can be rationalized in the name of God. Now comes suicide, the suicide bomber, which I'm going to maintain. I'm going out on a limb. I told you when I introduced this last week that I will tell you when I think that I'm telling you what the Torah says, and when I tell you what I think I'm saying. This is my opinion. The following is my opinion, not forced by any sources, not being said in the name of any source or in the name of the Torah itself. I think it is a responsible interpretation, but I think that it is. I have to say that it's original and it could very well be wrong. Suicide, killing, suicide murder, is a perfect manifestation of Yishmael's philosophy. It's the ultimate. It's almost a predictable result, I would say. What do we know about war? And see, this is what you find the political commentators nowadays struggling with. There used to be, I think we've already gotten beyond this, but there used to be the following notion about the terrorist mind. The terrorist mind is the mind of someone who has no hope. The terrorist mind is the mind of somebody who already knows that if he stays alive, he has no future, he's desperate, his parents have no jobs, he has no career, he has no education, and he's been pushed around by soldiers and by imperialists and by Westerners, and he totally has no self-esteem, and he's desperate, and therefore he has no reason to live, and therefore he blows himself up to take out a few other people. That is the Western interpretation of a suicide bomber. Why do we say that? Because the Western mind is an unbelievably narrow, stubborn, self-centered mind. And the Western mind thinks that everybody thinks like us. Just they do things a little bit differently. They dress a little bit weird, and they sleep with their animals. But they're really us, okay? I don't mean sleep with their animals. I mean next to. Okay, so there you go. In the same tent. Okay, so... And that's why, by the way, that's why Westerners actually think that you can negotiate with terrorists. In other words, you're willing to slash the throat of children who have nothing to do with your fight in order to impose your will on others. But if you sit down at a table with a suit and tie on and you sign an agreement, obviously you mean it. I can trust you. It just doesn't make any sense. That's the Western mind. The Western mind thinks that there's no difference between Israel negotiating with Arafat and the Democrats hammering out a bill in committee with the Republicans. Same thing. They don't get it. So, but the point is that that's the line that we wrote about the suicide bomber. That's the story. Meanwhile, someone did a study in which they took the suicide bombers and they looked at their profiles, and they find that most of the suicide bombers come from families that are earning a living, they are college graduates, or they're in the middle of college, they're successful lawyers. These women who started blowing themselves up were all doing very, very well. Some of them, one was pregnant, some of them were just gotten married or were engaged to be married, their lives were going fine. This defies any logic at all. It defies any rule of warfare that we know. What's the rule of warfare? You mass against the enemy, or you strategize against the enemy because you want to win so that you can act. You don't want to hurt yourself in the process of accomplishing your goals. And all of a sudden, the primary tool of Ishmael is the individual who's willing to die in order to take out others. It goes against logic. The Jewish people is confronted, by the way, it started with the war against the Jews. The terrorism did not start somewhere else and spread to Israel. Terrorism started in Israel. Started back in mostly in the 60s and the 70s, primarily against Israel. The rest of the world did almost nothing to stop it. It didn't bother anybody, and therefore the whole world now suffers from terrorism because it's out of control. But the point is that it's a tool that was developed specifically to fight the state of Israel. And we're confronted with an enemy that doesn't follow any logic at all. Because by definition, the whole assault of Yishmael is that the order of the world shall not be. What we call civilization, which is a construct in which things make sense. There's a government, there are rules, there are boundaries, there are borders, there's allowed, there's not allowed, there's right and there's wrong. The whole idea of Pera Adam is that there's absolutely, it's all arbitrary. There's no system at all. So the Western mind thinks, okay, what we'll do is we're going to come in with fancy gunships and fancy tanks with night vision goggles, and we're going to shoot them up, and we're going to put in a parliament, they're going to be an election, and it's just going to work because all they need is a chance. They don't understand that the culture of Ishmael, and I don't mean just I'm talking about the ideological force that has brought Ishmael into the world, is about there is no order. They don't stand for representative government. They don't stand for the idea of authority. They stand for no authority. They literally stand for anarchy. That's what Ishmael is all about. That's the dust of your feet. That whatever you want goes. That's the whole idea here. So therefore, you're never going, I'm just saying it straight out, you're never going to find democracy take hold in the Arab world. Won't happen. That's what I was just saying. You heard it here first. It won't happen. We're going to do whatever we can to fool ourselves into thinking that we got it. We'll make all kinds of names, we'll make a parliament, and Mubarak will make announcements, and Syria will then say that they're liberalizing, and now Saudi Arabia's got all kinds of municipal elections going on. Ain't going to happen. Just telling you. Now look what's going on in Iraq right now already. I mean, the United States State Department just issued a report last week citing the new government that we're supporting for excessive human rights abuses in Iraq. Okay? Duh. Because, I mean, that's, the only question is who's in power, who gets to abuse the other. That's the only question. They're dealing with blood avenging that goes on from, they don't even remember who killed whom several centuries ago, and this is what's governing the Shiites and the Sunnis, and it's crazy. But this is, it's crazy from our point of view. From their point of view, it's totally logical. This is what it's all about. But the point I'm demonstrating is that suicide is that tool which comes from an entity which doesn't believe in any rationale. And therefore, we're confronted with an enemy that says, I'm so willing to have you die that I'm willing to die in the process myself. And not only an old man, but the young, the ones who are the promise of the future, the what, and our own children. And then we'll sit there in our Shiva tents and we'll celebrate them as martyrs. By the way, I speak without authority about the faith of Islam. I do not know Islam well. I have not studied it well. I do know, however, and I've discussed this with people specifically to check this out, that the business with the 70 versions is an accurate rendition of what they consider to be the promise of the afterlife for a martyr's death. Now, I just want to point out that that idea of Olam Haba, the world to come, as 70 versions, is exactly what I'm talking about. This is exactly what I'm talking about. It's the perfect Olam Haba for a nation which says that the goal is to bring God down here, not for this world to be elevated up there. So therefore, what do? They describe Olam Haba as, right, as physical life. It's the ultimate, you know, the world to come is going to be sexual bliss. It's not a metaphor. You know, I used to think of it when I was younger that, oh no, it's just their way of describing the ultimate spiritual pleasure. They're using the only terms that are available to us. No. It is what they believe lies in store for someone who is the ultimate servant of God, is the 70 versions. So the point is that this is exactly the kind of a religion that believes that the connection to God is going to be in the physical universe, not that the physical universe is going to be elevated up to the spiritual realm. Now let me just point out a couple of things here before we close. Let's just talk about Esau for a minute. Esau is who? Esau is a descendant of Isaac and Rebekah. Okay, Isaac and Rebekah comes from Milcah, comes from Nahor, and they produce these twins, Jacob, that, and Jacob of course has the 12 tribes, so all of his children are all Israel. And then you have Esau. Esau in Hebrew is Esau, okay? That is the same, the root, that word, asui, means a couple of things. One thing it means is, he's thus, which means that Esau's philosophy is that man is not adama, potential, that's supposed to develop, but man is just whatever he is that's what he is. Just leave me alone. Just let me eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow I shall die. And what does Esau say, as a matter of fact? When he comes in at the day of the funeral of his grandfather Abraham, he says to Yaakov, Hinei anachi halei chamus, I am going to die, v'lama li zebachara. Why do I care about the birthright? The birthright was all about serving God. He's saying, I'm going to die. This is the way it is. Just, you know, forget about tomorrow and the afterlife and serving God in connection. I'm tired, right? Give me from this red soup because I'm tired. And say you say tired means I'm exhausted from sex and murder. But anyway, so Esau is this guy who doesn't believe in progression and self-development. He just believes it also means accomplishment, like Oseh, accomplishment. Esau's major tool is technology, because technology says that I'm going to be able to master and organize the world through my own insight and understanding. This is really. So it's very fascinating when you look at this. So the United States gets attacked by Ishmael, by people speaking in the name of Ishmael, who specifically say the United States is evil because of their alliance, by the way, with Israel. And what is Esau? The United States is a clear manifestation of Esau, and I will point out that it does not make the United States evil, because again, we're not talking about the personality, we're talking about the philosophic representation. The United States is clearly the leader of the Western world. And so Esau has Esav has some many redeeming features, particularly because Esav comes from Yitzchak and Rivka. He is going to be a distortion of something good, and that's why you end up with a Christian church defined by love, which also does a lot of murder, right? Because they believe in love authentically. They also do a lot of murder authentically. So it's a mixed up. It's a mixed up thing. This is what's going on. Abraham produces a Yishmael, which is a siphoning off of a certain spiritual imperfection. Yitzchak produces an Esav, which is a siphoning off of a certain spiritual imperfection. And we end up with a Yaakov, who ends up producing 12 tribes with no spiritual imperfections. And that's why the process of fatherhood is over with Yaakov, because we've filtered out, so to speak, the spiritual defect, and we end up with the product, which is now ready to emerge on the scene as the nation of Israel. That's the whole idea. So back to this idea. So Esav, what does Esav do when he's attacked by Yishmael in 9-11? Right? What does he do? Does he say, there's an interesting ideology over here? No. The first thing Esav says is, we are not against the nation of Islam. We are not against Muslims. We do not have a religious war. We're not. We're just against terrorism. So what do? We go to the mountains of Afghanistan with our night scope vision and with our dynamite and with our special stuff, and we're going to use technology and we're going to blow the living daylights out of these people in the mountains of Tora Bora. And then we go into Iraq and we think we're going to fix everything again with this new high-tech war where we don't even have to touch the enemy, and we can, you know, whatever it is, and we have minimal casualties, we can do it in a few days and everything's going to be fine. And then we find out that no matter what we do, they're not dead. The war was over. That's when the war began. When mission accomplished, because Esav relies on technology. Esav is not going to get into my idea versus your idea. Esav is a guy who manipulates the physical world. Yishmael, meanwhile, is laughing at Esav. Yishmael is saying, no, I'm living in the name of God. God's on my side. And it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. Whatever I feel is what God wants. And I'm indomitable, and I can't be stopped. Yishmael is feeling terribly threatened by Esav's technology, which threatens to corrupt its youth and to take it away from their idea of spirituality. Esav is feeling terribly threatened by Yishmael, who says that to heck with your world order. I'm going to show you that wherever you go, you can't control the world. You can't make things go right. You're going to go to airports and spend hours standing in line trying to get on an airplane just to go to Augusta, and so on and so forth. And that's what Yishmael is saying, right? And Esav is feeling terribly threatened. So Esav thinks what I got to do is blast the living daylights out of them. And what they're saying is that what I got to do is simply disrupt the whole thing. What's happening is the world order of these two powers is both being terribly threatened. So comes a Medrash at 8:31. Is that what it is? I lost my glasses. Anyway, but a new pair is coming at 8:31. So there's a fascinating Medrash. The Medrash says, "Kishera Isa, when you see Umos Ha'olam Misgarin Zevazet, the nations of the world inciting each other, right? Prepare for the coming of the Mashiach." What does that mean? What does that mean? Just when the world's falling apart, so the Mashiach's coming. We've been saying that for a long time. The world's been falling apart for a long time. What the Medrash, I believe, is saying is that the Mashiach, which is nothing other than the Mem of Adam, you remember, the final letter of Adam's name that we talked about last week, the Mem of Adam, which is the manifestation of what Adam was created for in the first place when he was inserted into the world, which is to be the conductor and the coordinator of all of the universe, to elevate the world, to discover God and to connect to God, to connect to its source. The exact opposite, by the way, of Yishmael. To bring the world up to heaven, so to speak, and to connect it to the source. So when Mashiach, in order for that to happen, the present order has to be destroyed. And this is exactly what's going on. Yishmael thinks his problem is Esav. Esav thinks his problem is Yishmael. And the truth is the only solution is Yisrael. Because Yisrael, we're going to talk about next week, Yisrael is the one that has the proper response to the whole problem. So we're going to try next week to articulate what Israel, I don't mean the state of Israel, I mean the people Israel, the historic force called Israel, what Israel has to offer the world, and what is supposed to happen in response to the assault of Yishmael against Esav and Esav's terribly clumsy response that will to impose its own order on Yisrael. It's just hysterical, bringing democracy to Iraq. It's like funny. Okay. Anyway. I mean, I wish Bush well. He's Asa. It's not his fault. He's Asa. He can't help it. It's all he has. We got the power, and I'll tell it to you next week. Okay, so that's the story. Any questions about this? Am I losing you? Do I sound a little bit fantastic, like some kind of a Christian 700 Club kind of a guy? Huh? Is that what you're thinking? Okay, because...
Is this all predetermined?
Yes, in other words, here's the point. Let me just say this one point. In order for Israel to develop its strength and to become the mem, so to speak, of Adam, which means the conclusion of human history, the realization of what Adam was created for, in order for that to happen, we have got to be challenged by Yisrael and by Esau. Because that's going to bring... Right. So that's going to bring out who we are. See, we're going to try everything in the world, right? For example, the state of Israel thinks that its solution is to act like Esau, right? So we figure we're going to develop ourselves technologically and computers and science and so on and so forth, and that's going to handle it. Because we have forgotten as a people what our real power is. Right? That's my major thesis, is that if we know where we come from, if we know what's going on in this whole map, if we understand what Adam is, if we understand what the role man is supposed to play in the world, and what the nation of Israel is supposed to do for humanity, then we'll stop barking up this tree, and we're certainly going to stop barking up this tree, and we're going to realize that the way to stop this thing is to go to our own power. And we're going to talk next week about what our own power is.
Well, okay. It was predetermined because
Israel
was born, and the Quran is written much later.
Yeah, that's true. The force is, that's right. When Ishmael was born, that's true. That's the whole point. That's what's amazing. When we're talking about the story of the birth of Isaac, the Torah first tells you the story of the birth of Ishmael. Ishmael has to be in the world in order for Isaac to have a struggle with him. Because if Isaac doesn't have a struggle with Ishmael, he himself is not smelted, like in a smelting furnace. And the same with Esav and Yaakov, by the way. It's the same problem. So the point is that our spiritual enemies here are just that. They're spiritual enemies that are there in order to force us into our own strength. We're only going to do that when we encounter the alternative. That's the whole idea here. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.